So it's my great pleasure to welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Rose Volkhausen. She is the author of this book, Journey, From Political Activism to the Work, and has been a deeply engaged spiritual practitioner for these many years, decades, I guess it's fair to say. I think I've known Rose for probably around a couple of decades, but I've gotten to know her much better in the last 10 years or so, I think it's fair to say. And so I know that we are in for a treat this evening. I was really glad when Rose let me know that she was going to be coming to the area and was going to be able to talk on this subject that a lot of people are thinking a lot about these days. And so, without further ado then, please join me in welcoming Rose Volkhausen to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
So I feel really grateful to have the chance to talk together tonight. It's such an intense time, and for myself, I feel the need to come together with other people who share an intention to live from a deep love and compassion, and who are searching for the ways to respond to what's happening around us right now. I'm a woman of a certain age, so I grew up in the time of the civil rights demonstrations, the demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, and so in a way, like, the whole momentum of the march right after the inauguration and the gatherings that are happening is very reminiscent of that time. Some things are very similar and some things are very different. But I'm reminded, when I feel hopeless looking at what's happening around us, I'm reminded that there was a point where integration of the schools seemed impossible. Where I lived, they closed the schools rather than integrate. There were no public schools for a year rather than integrate, and the courts finally forced the schools to open and integrate. So integration, it just of the schools and the restaurants, looked impossible, and we are just coming from 8 years of having an African-American president. So what looks impossible is not impossible. And the same thing with Vietnam War. It's like, you know, my boyfriend was going off to, I was a Quaker pacifist, and my boyfriend was going off to fight in Vietnam. It's like the intensity of the different currents at that time were so strong, it was, in a way, seemed impossible to imagine how the country could come together, and it also seemed impossible to interrupt the juggernaut of an unauthorized illegal war. And eventually, even though it took a long time, it did stop, and those demonstrations made a difference. So I come from a background of facing what looks like impossible power ranged against us and seeing that people coming together makes a difference. I come from a Quaker background, which we are a pacifist church. So my father was a conscientious objector in World War II, and the Quakers, because of the belief that there is the divine in every person, feel called to work with economic and social justice as part of supporting the possibility of the divine in every person. So I come from a background where the spiritual path and political action are meet. And at the same time, I feel that when I was politically active in my 20s, I had a very different view than I have now, 40 years later. So since that time of very engaged, like, action in the streets, I've gone through being in a spiritual group that I finally realized had become a cult, and I was so naive that I knew nothing of what to look for. Leaving that group, having no interest in finding another spiritual teacher, and then stumbling into another spiritual group which was completely different. And if I had known the signs to look for, I would have known the difference between the first and the second. But I learned that through hard personal experience, not through having enough education to even look in a book to get some education about who do you trust and who don't you trust when you're looking for guidance. So I've been involved in the second spiritual community for about 30 years now, and it's home for me. And I feel that I've grown tremendously through my involvement in that spiritual path. And at the same time, I have been touched by many other spiritual paths, because one of the differences between a cult and a real spiritual school is that a real spiritual school recognizes the value and the gift of every other practice on the spiritual path, that we are all parts of one path, whereas a cult shuts out everyone but our supposedly perfect path. So I've been very touched by many other spiritual communities that I have come into contact with through my school. The school I'm in, it's a small school. We have maybe 200 members of the community across the planet, and but I know people in schools that have thousands, and I know people in schools who have, you know, maybe 100, and I think all these different schools are doing very, very important work. So one of the things that has changed for me when it was Robin Stewart who came up with this title, but I loved it, From Political Activism to Sacred Activism. I feel that I've learned something about deeper roots of action, whatever that action is. And that action could be prayer, or it could be civil disobedience and arrest, or it could be running for political office. Action can take many, many different forms. But when I was in my 20s, although I believed that there was an energy of the divine, and I believed that we were held by a greater love and intelligence, I also, in how I lived, really thought that I had to save the world, kind of by myself, with some other people that, you know, were going to help me do it. But there was really, you know, I was the oldest of four children and the only girl, and I took care of my brothers. So I really wanted to be like a big sister to the world, and at this age, my tendency would want to be to mother the world. And there's value in that, but there's also a kind of human hubris that I think is really important to examine. The first kind of hint I had that all my political ideals might not be enough by themselves was when we were working on organizing an action as part of, I don't know, depends on your age. I don't know how many of you remember May Day 1971, but it was a huge, I think at the time it was the biggest political action that had been organized in U.S. history, possibly. There'd been the I Have a Dream speech, maybe that was even bigger, but it was one of several landmark political actions by the U.S. populace. And our intention, or the intention of the organizers, was to take over Washington, D.C. and shut down the government and show that illegal war could not be carried on without citizen effective objection. I was part of a much smaller demonstration that was at the side of that was organized by radical Quakers and radical Catholics. And that's an interesting combination, because Quakers are so simple that there's no dogma, no minister, no hierarchy, no ritual. You sit on wooden benches and you're quiet for an hour unless someone feels moved by the inner voice of the divine, to speak. Whereas Catholics, as you know, have every kind of most elaborate, I think beautiful ritual, stained glass and incense and chanting in Latin and priests and congregation and hierarchy, and totally different. And yet radical Quakers and radical Catholics have worked together a lot in the last 50 years because of a similar commitment to carrying out love of the divine in loving action for human beings. So we were organizing a smaller demonstration directed at the Selective Service, where boys were being drafted. And in the organizing, the women began to realize that the men didn't listen to us. And it was such a shock, because it was just the beginning of the women's liberation movement. Like, the first big women's liberation gathering had been just a couple years before. It was so new for the women to be thinking about, is there a different way to see myself and to ask men to see me than what I take for granted? And I grew up taking for granted that my mom and dad loved each other, and my dad said what he thought, and my mom was kind of quiet. I mean, my mom was smart, and if you got her talking, she had a lot to say, but my dad was in charge, and my mom supported him. And I didn't really notice that the men were making the decisions and having the caucuses, and we were kind of bringing the coffee, until some other women started saying, this doesn't work for us. And it was really a shock for me, not just a shock that there was a differential, but a shock that I hadn't even noticed. It was just like, this is fine, we're all working together. And then we started talking with the men, and they didn't know what we were talking about. And that was another shock. It was like, we're so used to this. We're like they say that cats that grow up in a box that has bars painted on the box, when they are let out of the box, they, if you put a fence in front of them with bars, they can't see the bars and they bang into the fence, because they assume that that's the way the world looks, is there's these bars, so they don't even see them. So we didn't see, and the men didn't see, that there was a difference in how the women and the men were being treated. It was the first glimpse for me that I might have personal work to do, that the work of saving the world was not just going to be out there, and that it might involve conflict with myself and with people I loved. And it took me from then almost 10 years before I embarked on a specific spiritual path. But that was the beginning of an inner work at a different level, as well as outer work. So when I look at the situation now, my political views are evident. I haven't even asked if anybody agrees or disagrees with how I see the world, but it must be obvious that for me, I see Donald Trump as behaving without compassion or conscience, and behaving in a way that I see creating suffering and more suffering in the world around him, and that's horrifying for me. And at the same time, I have a view of this that's quite different than I had when I was 20, because I see Donald Trump and the whole world that created him, the people that voted for him, the people that think his rhetoric is fine, as mirrors from my own inner shadow. And when I was 20, that never occurred to me. It never occurred to me that someone behaving without conscience like that outside me could be mirroring me, because I was convinced that I had conscience. I had conscience handled. I was the conscience of the world, and I was on the streets to not violently but non-violently force the world into living with conscience as I understood it. And I knew very little about listening to anybody else or even myself, so I had some very good ideals but very little self-knowledge and very little skillful means. So Socrates says the whole path is know thyself. I did not know myself, and I don't know myself now at the level that I know is possible, but I at least have learned some things about myself, and I know I have a lot more to learn. So for me, it's a profound challenge to let the lack of conscience I see outside me mirror to me where might I be acting without conscience, where might I be acting with prejudice, what work might I have to do in myself to bring a deeper compassion into the world. So that's the first thing. I feel that to respond to this situation, we have to respond if we're to be effective, we have to respond by becoming more inclusive, not more separative, even with people who are doing hateful things. I went to the Place de la République in Paris, where bombs were set off and 100 young people died, and that statue has become a shrine. It's filled with flowers, candles, people chanting, meditating, walking quietly around it, and the energy is not of hate or violence. The energy is of compassion and even forgiveness. And I was shocked to see that. I thought there would be some people with fists raised and stamping and like, no more. But it wasn't like that. It was deeply, deeply reflective of an energy of coming together in the face of violence and hate. And one of the signs, that's one of the banners that they've hung along the fence around that place, says, not our hate. And another one said something like, we choose love. And I just found that so inspiring. So that means love is totally inclusive, even of people that seem hateful or rejecting. And those, I find, are somewhat easy words to say, but to actually live from that is not easy. I have trouble being loving towards somebody who leaves dirty dishes in the sink and it's midnight when I come home. So to feel loving towards someone who's creating tremendous suffering in the world, I mean, what does that mean? It's not an easy love. It's not a... it can't be a cheap love. It's not a shallow love. It has to be a real deep, in a way, ruthless love that's willing to speak truth to power, willing to recognize what's wrong, but respond from a deeper place than polarization. So that's one of the things that's changed for me. A second one is that this may sound heretical, but I no longer think that saving the world of this planet, making this a perfect place to live, is the full purpose of human life. I think this world may be almost like an apprenticeship for deeper work that we do after we leave this body. I no longer think that our life in the human body is our only life or our only work. And that's given me a little more humility than I had when I was 20, and a little more openness to a very long-term view. So I think we're here to serve, I think we're here to grow, and I think we're here to wake up. Like in the Gurdjieffian terms, I think we are largely asleep, and we have the work of waking ourselves up. And you know what it's like when you're dreaming and you know that it's a dream, but you can't wake yourself up? It's hard work. Like my experience when I'm dreaming and suddenly I know this is a nightmare and I want to wake myself up, it's like a physical fight from inside to try to wake up from the dream. So that struggle to wake ourselves up in a spiritual sense, I think it's a lifelong work and probably a work of many lifetimes. But we have moments. I think we have moments every day where for an instant we're awake, and we have to nourish those moments. So it seems to me that the election of Donald Trump in this country has to a certain degree waked up not only people in this country but people across the whole world. My mom's 98, so she was too old to go marching when they had the march the day after the inauguration, but I was with her and we watched on TV, and it was so amazing to see that it was not just people all the way, all across the United States, big cities and little towns, and you know, even 20 people in some like Podunk town and you know, middle America, but it was people all across the world. It was people in Ghana, in India, in London, like big cities, little countryside villages. So people are waked up and they're coming together, and that I think has a value beyond what we can imagine. If we can keep responding to the external situation in this world by waking up internally, that is invaluable. And there's so much that we need to wake up to. There's climate change, and there's prejudice, and there's immigration, and there's economic injustice, and then there's also our own personal shadow and light. And I believe that those external challenges will only be handled as we wake up as a human race internally, as our conscience awakens and we live from a different place inside. I saw a quote from Osho, from Rajneesh, the other day, and I have some friends that were on Rajneesh's, in Rajneesh's school, but I know very little of that school from personal experience. But I thought this quote was very impressive. He was saying, I'm not here to teach you about morality, about what's right and what's wrong in a moral sense. He said, I'm here to help you awaken. And he said, if you are not awakened, if you're coming from sleep, you can do things that look very good and are good in a sense, but there's something wrong because you are coming from a state of sleep. If you're doing something from an awakened state, what you do will be good. And that's something that I think I had no idea about when I was 20. I thought my state of consciousness was sufficient, basically. And that's, again, that's human hubris. In the 40 years since then, I have had glimpses of a wider state of consciousness. I've had glimpses of the divine that holds us and that is guiding us. I've had glimpses that there are universal patterns far beyond the external forms of this earth. And I think to try to create external political change without attention to that deeper state of awareness is by nature a dead end. It's by nature flawed and ultimately a dead end. Because historically, the oppressed wake up to the external injustice, take power, overcome the oppressors, and become the oppressors, because we don't know ourselves. Because I don't know the lust for power in myself. When I suddenly have power in a group situation, I discover myself behaving in a way that is horrifying to me. I may not be taking out guns and swords, but I can treat people with in a way that diminishes them, in a way that is cruel, and is a way that is doing power trips that I had no idea about. And power trips are not always I have found that the most insidious power trips are sometimes the ones that are less visible. I can try to take people's power by being too nice to them. One of my dynamics is to try to rescue people. So I can be the nice mother, the good mother, and so kind and so nice and so approving that people start turning to me to be their good mother. And all of a sudden they're leaning on me and I'm feeling drained, and they're feeling that their goodness is found by hanging on to me. And I've robbed them of their own power in their own being. That is a power trip, even though it looks so nice on the outside. And that's, I know from personal experience, that's how a cult begins. The leader of the cult I was in began by being a savior in my life, the kindest, most compassionate, most giving person I had ever met. But there were other things going on behind that. And in the end, I was losing my sense of myself. I had cut off connections with all my family. I had lost my life because I was so desperately clinging to this person as the one who gave my life meaning. So So these patterns, we could see these patterns on a large global scale, and we could see them in each of us as human beings and in the groups that we work with. And I think groups are part of the same saving grace of human spiritual work, of human possibility, because it's in groups that we're able to come together and to do a work that is rarely possible as an individual. So one of the most important things for me is simply to come together, like to sit with all of you in this room tonight, is to come together and to let ourselves be touched by each other to some degree, to let each other be an inspiration and a food for each other. I have several friends who've been deeply involved with AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and they tell me that the 12 steps are crucial, but a crucial step in 12 steps is I surrender to a higher power. It's recognition that I am incapable of handling this by myself, and I surrender to a higher power. And that surrender is what I feel was missing when I was 20. I had really no idea of what it might mean to actually let a higher power guide me and do the work to be in relationship with that divine guidance. Because divine guidance is not always easy, and it's not just being told what to do like a little robot. But it's also not just doing things the way that it looks good to me. It's like I have a body of habits and conditioning that give me certain very strong opinions and ways of behaving that are not always best. And to dismantle that conditioned machine takes a lot of daily work. One of the things my teacher died 6 years ago. He was a Western man, and he had Lee Lazowick, and he had an Indian master, Yogi Ram Surat Kumar. So Lee and his teacher were extremely different, and at the same time, totally in unity together, resonance together. So Lee worked with us in a very, he was very used to working with Westerners. But Yogi Ram Surat Kumar, who grew up in India on the side of the Ganges and lived first as a beggar and then in an ashram in South India, he also knew how to work with Westerners. So I come from a background in my community of working with both Eastern traditions and Western ways of working. But something Lee used to criticize in me was that you know, when you go in a public restroom and then you wash your hands and then they either have a hand dryer or they have paper towels. Well, I hate both of them. So I would never dry my hands. I would come out of the bathroom and my hands would be dripping wet. And Lee'd be like, "You didn't dry your hands." I'm like, "No, if I use the paper towels, it eats up trees. It's killing trees if I use the paper towels. And if I use the you know, electric thing, it's costing electricity. Plus, I hate the sound of it. So I'm just going to air dry my hands." And he's like, "It's like, you could just dry your hands." I'm like, "No, I don't like to dry my hands." And then we'd go to meet somebody. Like, we'd have been, like, stopped at the gas station just before going to meet some teacher and group in another community. And we'd get there, and people would reach out their hands to shake their hands, and my hands would still be wet. And I'm like, "Oh, my God, I'm shaking this teacher's hand with wet hands. It's so rude." I'd be like, "My teacher told me to dry my hands, but I wouldn't do it." I'd be like, "Next time, I'm going to dry my hands." I mean, really, I was with my teacher for 20 years before he died. And when he died, sometimes I was drying my hands, I was still walking out without drying my hands. He said, "After I die, you can write an autobiography about your work with me, and you can call it Unwilling to Dry My Hands." You know, you have to either laugh or cry. Because it's so simple. I've committed my whole life to this path. but I won't dry my hands because I have my political ideals about what it costs to dry my hands, and I am going to do it my way. And that's just the simplest of examples. I mean, being a mother, raising my son, there were so many things I came up against where I had ingrained ideas about how to mother a child, and people are begging me how to look at my habits and not pass them on to my child. And I am invulnerable because that's my security, is this is the way I do things. Like, one of the things people said to me was, your son, he has a sensitivity, and sometimes, even at age 1.5, he's just sitting looking at the light and he doesn't want to be disturbed. And you race up to him and offer him toys and talk to him and engage him because you're so desperate to make sure that you have a relationship. You think that you're engaging him, that you're making sure that he knows he has a mother who's present, but no, you won't just let him be and be present to him. And I heard that with my mind, and it made so much sense to me. And then I would catch myself, having already raced into the room with these, like, you know, wooden trains. Like, don't you want to make some track with the wooden train? I'm like, oh my heavens, I just did it again. Because the habit is so strong. Our habit body is so strong, and we have no idea what that costs us. So to struggle with our habit body is gradually to begin to have more softness, more vulnerability, where we can actually feel what might be true and real for this particular moment. Like, what might be the most true and real thing that you and I could say to each other this evening? There has to be some softness and some vulnerability to get to that. So that's, for me, been the work of decades now, to reach a deeper and deeper level of vulnerability to myself, to other human beings, and to a divine presence. And it's a work that is very much in process. In some moments, I'm so dense and insensitive, and then when I see it, I'm so horrified. And in other moments, there's this instant of communion with other human beings, including at some moments, like, there was a moment, I can't even remember what I was doing, but somehow I was walking on a street in Prescott, where we live, and I was just lost in myself, and all of a sudden I looked up, and I just looked straight into the eyes of the woman who was walking toward me, and she smiled at me, and there was this instant of meeting, as if I went through her eyes into her soul, and I felt seen by her. I was like, oh, it just took my breath away. And then we had passed each other, and I turned and I looked after her, and I saw she was dressed in a kind of like Prescott conventional dress. I went, that woman probably voted for Trump. If I had been looking before I saw her, I would have been so shut down to her. I would have been angry and defended and, oh, she's one of them. Not because I want to think that way. It just would have been the habit body coming up, and there would have been no chance of meeting. But because I was completely undefended, and something in her being saw me, I don't know why, but it was deeper than her politics or my politics. I know it was real. It was for an instant. And I know she felt seen by me. I saw that she felt something passed between us. And that got to happen because my habit body didn't get a chance to be in the way. So that's a reminder for me about how I want to live. And to have that openness, it's not to think that what Trump is doing is right. It's not to think that it's right if she thinks it's fine to close the borders to Muslims. I don't think we have to question values that we know are real and true, and that we've come to through through the work of living, I have come to know that compassion is a better place to live from than cruelty. I don't feel I need to question that. But I need to question whether I am bringing compassion to the interaction I'm having in this moment, and whether I'm bringing compassion to how I respond to what's happening in the world around me. So I feel now that we have a deep knowing that's already present, that's always been there. My teacher said we are already presently enlightened, we've just forgotten. So it's not there's someone out there who's enlightened, who's going to show me how to live. There are people who could guide me, and I want that guidance, but they're guiding me to myself. And within myself, I find the entire divine. Within each of you, if I'm open, I find the entire divine. The entire divine is within us and outside us. So from that place of being, we can know what is the sacred activism that is called for from each of us. And for me now, I feel that the activism for me could be prayer. It could be no outer action in this particular moment, because I think prayer is effective beyond our wildest dreams. And I have seen that in my own relationship with my teacher, with Yogi Ramsarat Kumar, with my relationship with God. Not that they solve everything for us, not that they come down and like fix everything and make my friend live. When, you know, I had a friend who died from cancer, the divine didn't come down and heal that cancer, but the divine entered our journey together through her confrontation with that process. And in the moment that we buried her body, I felt her joy at liberation in a way that I could not have ever known about if the divine hadn't been there helping us in that process. So sacred activism may be prayer, and it may be intense action on the streets. It may be one thing for one person and one thing for another. It may be prayer for me in one moment and ending up in jail in another moment. There's entire range, but we have to find out what each of us is called to in each moment. I travel to India every few years to go to the ashram. Yogi Ramsarat Kumar died about 15 years ago, but there's a very established ashram where his devotees continue to carry on their work, and I go to visit at least every few years. And during the last trip, I went north to Rishikesh and Hardwar, which are, I don't know how many of you have visited India. So how many of you have been at least into the foothills of the Himalayas? So the Ganges comes out of the Himalayas. I've never been to the top, but it comes out of the Himalayas into the foothills, and it's a turquoise blue-green color, like icy cold from the glaciers, and it's clean. When it gets down to Benares, where everybody goes to bathe, and there's the burning ghats for the bodies to be burned when people die in the sacred city, it looks dirty. But that's partly mud, because it's stirred up mud there, and it probably partly is like trash and things, but it's a sacred river. And you can feel that it's sacred, whether it's muddy or whether it's clean, but when it's coming out of the Himalayas, it's this icy, beautiful blue-green. And so you can go up to a tiny ashram where you could bathe in the Ganges and there's nobody else around, and it's freezing. I mean, you're being held by the mother, but you're shivering, but you've got to stay in until you're like fully like immersed. It's just, it's life-changing to be in her arms like that. And right next to the river, in that place, there is a cave where a sadhu, a saint, meditated and opened into enlightenment many, many years ago. And there's just a little plaque that says this saint meditated here and experienced enlightenment, and you can quietly go into the cave and sit there. And it says on the plaque, many people experience a tangible feeling of peace. And when I read that plaque, I thought, well, great, I want to go in the cave and I really want to be where this saint was, but I won't feel anything because I'm too dense. And so I don't, you know, and I'm not sure that those, you know, what they say about feeling peace, maybe that's people's kind of imagination of what they should feel. So I wasn't expecting anything, but you have to kind of almost, you have to bend down and go in through this little entry, and then it opens out, and then there's this inner cave with candles, and you sit. And I just sat down, and I can touch it even now, the feeling that arose. There was a physical, as if there was a substance in the space that was filled with peace. I mean, you know, in the Christian tradition they say, may you have the peace that passeth all understanding. That's what I felt. Like, we talk about world peace, but there's a deeper peace. There's a peace that passeth all understanding, and it was in the substance of that space. It's like, whatever happened for him, he left that awareness, left a permanent imprint through that human being in space-time. And you can feel it. And then you come out of that cave, and you walk down. That cave is kind of dug into, it's in the earth, in the side of the earth. But then you come out and you walk down to the Ganges, and you climb up a cliff, and there's a little just hollowed out space. It's hardly even a cave, but the hollowed out beginning of a cave in the side of the cliff, and that's where his wife meditated. And that is so full of the feminine, I just wanted to cry. I thought, if I ever disappear from everything I know and people don't know where to find me, that's where I'll be. That was like manna from heaven. It was as if I was eating like food of the mother. And they say that Jesus meditated there. They say that Jesus, that's a point that Jesus came to in India, and then he meditated there. Who knows? But there is historical evidence that she meditated there. So those are imprints in space-time from hundreds or thousands of years ago, and they're still vibrating. So that to me says prayer is powerful beyond our imagination. We don't have to save the world by ourselves, and that's what I thought when I was 20, that I had to save the world by myself, because I basically thought there is a God, but he's busy with other things, so he's abandoned us and we have to fix this, and it's a mess. But now I think he's totally with us. I mean, even though I was so excited about feminism and it was, you know, one of the doors opening in my life, I also see things differently than I saw them in the first opening of my feminist days. And I do think of God as being a masculine presence, not as if that shuts out the feminine. C.S. Lewis, who's Christian, says, in relation to the masculine of the divine, we are all feminine. And that's how I see it. Men and women, we are all feminine in relation to a masculine divine. But this is nothing to do with inequality of men and women. It's a whole different matrix. So that divine is with us and holding us in whatever we go through, even the worst that we may go through. And what we're seeing now, I think we don't know whether this is the beginning of worse and worse than we can imagine, or whether we will be able to turn this through worldwide coming together, turn this in a different direction. I don't feel confident of what direction this will go, but I do feel confident that there is a divine moving each of us and within us and holding us that will accompany us through whatever we are going to be facing. And to surrender to the direction of that divine, to move with that divine rather than trying to save the world by myself, is a whole different engagement. And that for me is sacred activism, whatever it brings me to. I realize I don't... do we go till 9? We do have a...
No, it's fine.
Okay.
Nine, but that would include questions.
Yeah, because I want to have some time for questions. So I'll talk just a little more, and then I'd like to have time for question and answer. For me, what I what I've discovered in the work on the spiritual path is that my essential relationship to the divine is a relationship to the divine as beloved. And so in this time when what's happening outside is in many ways so horrifying and so harsh, it's essential for me to come back to this relationship of lovers, that my relationship with the divine is relationship to a divine beloved, and that that colors my relationship with every human being, so that our relationship can be as soft and as tender as a relationship of lovers, even while we can also be fierce and firm and active when we need to be. But lovers can be fierce. I mean, a lover's fight is fierce and demanding. Lovers don't let each other off the hook. Lovers demand the best of each other because we see to the essence of the other and we want that essence and we won't settle for mediocrity. So lovers demand and challenge each other. They don't just softly love each other. There's both. And that's what I feel in my relationship with the divine, and that's what I want in my relationship with other human beings, is that we can challenge and demand and inquire and investigate and act together, but from a place which has tenderness and love and forgiveness. And to find forgiveness in this time, I think, is one of the greatest challenges. How to be with an order to shut our borders to Muslims and find a relationship that is open-hearted and not closed-heart. In moments just feels impossible to me. I just feel rage. And there's a place for that rage. I do not want to shut out the rage. I want to transform the rage. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche says that our lower emotions are fuel for our work. And I think our rage at an order like that is fuel for our work. So it's not to shut it down or to try to turn it to ice, to freeze it. It's to take that rage and be with it in the heart so that it transforms into a fire of real action. Again, whatever that action is, a fire of prayer, a fire of demonstration, a fire of marching. But all of that, whatever that fire is, has a vibration. Like there's a vibration from those caves in India. There's a vibration from the marching after the inauguration. There's a vibration from us coming together today. There's a vibration when two people sit down at coffee and come together in a true inquiry into what is called for from us in this time. Those vibrations, they make a difference in healing the world. So to nourish the vibration of healing and not the vibration of hate. Someone was telling me that there's research now that says that there's a universal field. The universe, I mean, they've said for a long time that everything in the universe is putting out vibrations. The stars are singing, a human being, our bodies are singing, we just can't hear it. So everything is vibrating. But they say now that there's a universal field of vibration that would naturally guide us. That when children get sick in a tribal culture, because they haven't been cut off from the universal field of vibration, they often know what they need for healing. They can go find the plant that they need for that fever because they're tuned into the universal field. But as Westerners, we have been so divorced, we've been taught to shut that down. It doesn't mean it's gone. It's in us, but we have to rediscover it. We rediscover that our vibration is in resonance with the universal field of vibration, and it can guide us. It can guide us in healing our physical bodies, our emotional bodies, our spiritual bodies, and it can guide us in healing this planet and this race. And whatever part we play in a much wider universe. Shortly before Lee died, he gave a talk. He had throat cancer, so at the end he couldn't really speak, so he wrote to us. And he would just write like a page or two to be read to our whole community. In one of these last writings, he said, there are scriptures that say that it's possible that this is a planet that is ruled by shadow. And I haven't read the Kabbalah, but I've heard that this is in the Kabbalah. This writer, C.S. Lewis, who's a Christian philosopher whom I love, he says this in his science fiction trilogy, that we are a planet ruled by a fallen angel, but the whole universe is not ruled by that angel. Our planet is ruled, like Lucifer is the ruling deity of our planet, not of the universe. And so there are ruling deities of other planets that are fully in the light. This planet is ruled by a fallen angel. And if that's true, then Lee was saying in this address, if that's true, then each of us has the possibility to choose to dedicate our will to the light that's beyond the shadow. In each moment and with our entire life, we have the choice whether to give our will to the will of the shadow, the will of the fallen angel that's ruling this planet, or whether to make a line of light through the shadow and surrender to a higher power. And that, to me, feels true, that's the possibility of a human life. And I don't think that we make that choice all in one moment. I think we fight and we struggle through our whole lives to recognize, when am I choosing selfishness and giving my will to the shadow, to the fallen angel? And when am I choosing compassion, forgiveness, courageous love, and giving my will to the rule of light and the rule of a divine power? So there are also scriptures that say that we are in a period of darkness, that this is foretold, this is prophecy. There's prophecy, the Hindu scriptures say we are in the Kali Yuga. There are Native American prophecies in North and South America that say that this is a time of darkness. So in one way, it's not surprising that we find darkness all around us. I believe that we came here by choice for this time. So we came here to bring light in the darkness, but to come into this planet, we have been touched and in some ways conditioned by layers of shadow. We have to struggle with that in ourselves, not just outside ourselves, to bring the full light that we're capable of carrying, that we're capable of awakening in ourselves and around ourselves, to bring that into a time of darkness and crisis. And the scriptures, the Hindu scriptures say, after the Kali Yuga comes a golden age. So that, to me, is something to turn toward when I need some food of hope that is worth engaging the struggle that we are engaged in within ourselves and around ourselves to go forward toward the light. So I want to open to questions and considerations. Anything any of you have to say? Yeah, Rob.
I was struck by your story about meeting the woman on the street in Prescott. And it reminded me of an occasion recently where at the gym I go to, I was dumbfounded one day to be the object of this really bizarre aggression. I won't go into describe the details of it, but this guy. And So the next time I saw the guy, he was in the gym. He was engaged in something, and my mind created a story around him. And the next time the same was true. I think it was the third time he walked into the dressing room, and my eyes just happened to be right at looking in that direction when he came in, and of course I had created the intention not to surrender my consciousness to the reactive response, but that it hadn't played out that way before. But in this particular occasion, my eyes were looking right at him as he came in, and his eyes coming in looked right at me, and I said, "Hello."
Wow.
And undefended.
Yeah.
And so we started talking. And see, it was sort of like a normal surface conversation. And then he was, you know, finishing, and then he turned to me and said, "Thank you for that. That you could do that." And I'm not just offering that as a story. My question to you is, because you described this occasion where suddenly your eyes met.
Yeah.
You know, and there was this opportunity to connect.
Yeah.
Without any forethought,
yeah.
Without the usual
preconceptions.
Preconceptions, yeah. Body of habit stuff that you were referring to coming up and intruding.
Yeah.
So one part of the question is, how do you see that sort of possibility arising for people? Is it just, do we seek to cultivate contexts where we can't avoid being with each other somehow?
Yeah.
Or do we seek to commit to being open to those contexts when they arise in the quote natural course of events?
Yeah.
And yes. That we can't predict.
It's a really good question. I think it's for myself, I don't feel called to try to create those contacts. I mean, my mom has a friend who's having a Valentine's Day party, and the conditions for the party are you have to bring one person from the opposite political party to this Valentine's Day. and you have to engage a caring conversation about the political situation. I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me?
God, maybe in 98.
There's no hope. I'm like, but you know, I mean, she's like, this woman is indomitable. I listen to that and I just go, you're going to have a free-for-all. You think you can handle human emotions. But she is committed. She says the condition is you come, you have a respectful and caring conversation about your political differences. So, of course, both people have to agree to it before they come. So you have to find someone that will agree. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, my mom said she's probably going to bring her nephew. Because he voted for Trump, and they just don't talk about it. You know? So she's going to say, would you come and talk with me?
Wow.
So this idea has really created response among the circle of people that knows this woman. So there are ways. I mean, you know, I was saying to Teresa earlier, if I were in my 20s, I would be wanting, I used to live in West Virginia on a little women's commune, well, I'd be wanting to go back down to West Virginia and go to door to door and talk to all the people that I knew down there who had no education, no jobs, and had, you know, black lung from the mines. I would be wanting, I mean, I loved those people, and they loved us, but they stopped having any relationship with us the day that an African-American woman came to stay with us. They never spoke to us again. But I haven't forgotten the heart connection. And there, it's complete paradox. They hated my friend. I love my friend, but I could never hate them because of what I experienced with them. I couldn't hate them for their hating her. So I would want to go back down and be involved in like education and helping with the economy and like reaching out to some of those people that voted for Trump that are going to get hurt the most by him. But that's not my job anymore. It just isn't. But there may be, I think there are people whose job it is. So for me, when that moment comes where I meet her eyes, it's a reminder that I take into my prayer life and I take into my heart openness to the world around me. It changed something for me. Because I was sliding. I felt like Lee gave that to me. It's like I was sliding into those people, and I just can't bear what they're doing. And all my ideas about I have to use it as a mirror, everything I said to you, I was sliding away from all of that. and it like woke me up a bit. So to take that moment to help me remember, and but I think again, I think we each have to find like what's our job? Is it our job to go and externally create those contexts, or is it our job to take those reminders into a deeper level of our spiritual path? And that, like I feel, for example, that the work you do at Tayu Center, or the work that I do with women in France, which is I do work with 6 to 12 women. It's very small groups doing very deep work, but I feel that radiates out. Every one of those women takes that work out into other ripples out into the world. Every person who's touched by Tayu Center takes something out. So it's a whole different way of rippling out than going and making direct contact with people who voted for Trump. Does that make sense?
Of course.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You're being given first choice.
How do you deal with exposing your psyche to day-to-day news events?
That, I think, is huge. I really think it's very important, because I think there are many people who have a pretty high level of awareness that can really... it's like there's our physical body and there's our subtle bodies, and the threads of our subtle bodies, which are holding a level of awareness that we've developed, those threads can be broken by too much impact from negative news. So for me, it's very important to find the balance between I want to know what's going on, so I'm not naive and I'm not blindsided. Like, if my Muslim friend can't get into the country, I mean, I want to know that's happening. At the same time, I don't want to be poisoned. So I have to find the balance where the foundation of my life is a life that's where I am eating food that nourishes the light, and from that foundation I can find out what's happening without being poisoned. And again, I think we have to find our individual place, but I think to really examine that is important, because there's a lot. I think some of the deepest shadow energy in this planet is the energy to feed fear, like way beyond any political party, even what's happening with Trump, or like in France there's a whole nationalist thing that's scary. Way beyond that, it's just the feeding of fear. I think fear is maybe the deepest specific shadow energy on this planet. So news that feeds fear is poisonous. So to be able to find out what's happening without letting fear get fed in us takes a lot of skillful means and acute attention to what is useful and what isn't. Thank you.
Yeah, you said considerations, and so I'm mm-hmm. assuming that
yeah.
I may respond to
yeah, definitely.
And I was drawn to come here this evening. I get invites from this place, and it's a very nice place.
Yeah.
All the time, and I've shown up a few times over the last few years. So thank you for blessing me and being here, and mm-hmm. as well as all of you.
Yeah.
I'm not a particularly bright person, and but it's I'm just going to shoot from the hip, and that is that, you know, we've been under fallen angels for a very long time, and the spiritual deceptions that have been perpetrated over hundreds of years keep most people lost. Even when it comes to prayer, people don't understand the nature of free will versus taking the name in vain, and how these things can cancel all these intentions out. In D.C., there is no such thing as Republicans and Democrats. They are pretty much one game of bar lawyers mm-hmm. serving bankers. And presidents, as Roosevelt said, are not elected. They're selected, mm-hmm. and the rest is a show for the public. And so, commenting on the Muslim issue, I had the nice opportunity to speak with and listen to Malcolm Shabazz speak 8 months before he was murdered in Mexico. And listening to this young man at the age of 28 is my contention that he was spiritually superior to both his grandfather, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King put together. He was therefore dangerous. He was dangerous as a vegan and what it means to be vegan, that it's a true great power, and that he was looking to unite black and brown labor. And for those reasons and others, he was taken out, and it's always curious to me how he is not spoken of more often. Regarding closing their borders, I think the borders should all be closed to everyone until we take care of our homeless veterans and children on the streets. But they have us discussing this one issue and getting angry, so we're like diverting energies in the wrong directions. And the marches, I beg to differ when you say about waking up. We're not awake at all. We have been taught to disregard the lessons of King and Gandhi and a few others in the past, where they exercised an action in shutting down the situation, the institution, the system, until the stated goal was attained. And so I find that this country, the people are doing everything and anything except the only thing that will set us free from the system, which is a shutdown. And I've shared for 25 years, and I've stumbled, and I've had some difficult times, so one of the reasons I came here is to be a little grounded. But I've shared a prophecy of a 40-day shutdown of the system, where it basically it says, Mammon shall no time standing still till two doors have opened. And the likes of most of us would be behind the second door, willing to do whatever it takes without violence to open the second door. And behind the second door is a brother named Leonard Peltier, who represents the 500-year indigenous resistance. And in his cell is the living spirit, the breathing spirit of the U.S. Constitution, which was a gift from a matriarchal society. We've never been under the U.S. Constitution. We've been under martial law all your lives. And they spend billions and billions of dollars to make sure we think that we're under one system when we're being controlled by the other. And I've done almost a million flyers in 15 years. And just this last month, I went to UC Davis, UC Berkeley. I went to all these events. I handed out 20,000 flyers, and I thought I was doing my very best in explaining things to these students. I'm showing them things. And I says, come meet me on the 9th, on the eve of the full moon, at the Port of Oakland, and let's just shut it down. I put out 20,000 flyers, and I had my friend drive me down there. And I was at the West Oakland BART where we were supposed to be, and there was one person there, me. And I said to my friend, well, I didn't get dressed up for nothing. So I went out there and I had my sign till Leonard Peltier is free. And the prophecy I was given is a 40-day shutdown of the system will set all free and walk us into the promised land seen by King and spoken of by the King of Kings. And the King of Kings cannot return. He's never left. He cannot die. He neither suffers fools nor alibis. And I was out there for an hour and a half. I had a great discussion with four cops, and I didn't mind being there by myself, but I knew that I can't stop an entire port. I stopped about 200 trucks for an hour and a half, and had an interesting time. But I just wanted to shoot from the hip in response to that. That the only thing that will make a difference is from their point of view. They are beyond laughing at marches. They don't care if you march. They don't care if you hold signs. The one thing they care about is stopping them, and there's one way to stop them, and that is to shut down the system. And I believe Israel is the promised land, but it's not a speck of dust across the sea. It has another name, Ariel, which means the world, and America represents the world, and California is, pardon me, the shit. This is the true heart and center of the new promised land that must be opened by the 40-day shutdown of the system. And the Oakland port is the most beautiful place to do this, because just by having enough people there will bring out the cops, which are not bad people, most of them. But because of what happened 10 years ago, they have said that if there's cops on our port, we will not work. And so therefore, within 24 hours of that happening, all 29 ports will shut down. And the women, it's time for the goddess to rule and be arisen to bust the chains of this prison. And everything can begin to change in the right direction. But as long as we maintain the system by our purchases and maintaining the slaughterhouse and the oil industry, all these things, all actions are as if not. And so I'll just share this last thing. I am all things the Spirit sings. I'm the best, I'm the worst, I'm the blessed, I'm the cursed. I be you as you be me, and we're here to set it all free.
Thank you for sharing.
I'll chase one man out.
Anybody else? Me? Yeah, Teresa.
It's so... I totally get everything you're saying, and I'm like, yes, yes, yes. The only thing that I feel myself, like I can instantly feel like, too, is the concept of using what's happening as a mirror. Because I feel like, I don't feel like I don't have any of these, whatever, but how, what does that mean exactly? Like, when you're using what's happening as a mirror, or someone who voted for Trump as a mirror, what the way I'm interpreting it is, I have to see in myself what this person has, or whatever. And that just feels, like I have huge, I mean, rational or not, I have huge resistance to that.
Yeah.
So what does that mean exactly, to use them as a
mirror? Yeah, thank you, because I think it's a really important place to look further. So I don't mean that we have to see exactly in ourselves what it's like. It's just, I don't think we have to pretend, I don't think we have to pretend that we are open to cruelty being as good a value as compassion. We've earned a real knowledge, a real wisdom, that it's better to live from compassion. So I don't have to pretend that I have the particular kind of cruelty that I would shut the borders to Muslims. But I do feel that this entire circumstance has exposed the shadow of the collective.
Right.
And I hold both the light and the shadow of the collective. That whole light and shadow can be found in me as well as outside me. So it's a reminder of the horror of the situation.
Okay.
And it can help me look. I find I have to respond in that way, because otherwise I start thinking they're really bad and I'm so good. And that's where I started 40 years ago.
Mm.
And it's the doorway to a self-righteousness that separates me from other people, from you, from my community, from the people I love. When people talk to me about how do I hurt them, one of the biggest things I hear is that you're self-righteous. You know, if you just hear me talk at a talk, it's probably not real visible. But if you have to live with me every day, and you have to wash dishes next to me, and you get to feel, how do I hurt people? You're going to find out that I rescue people. You're going to find out that I'm self-righteous. You're going to find out that I am a bulldog with my opinions and have a very hard time listening if you have a different opinion than me. And that when I actually do discover that you're right, I may be very relieved, but we may have gone through a lot of pain together before we got there. So those are the kind of things where I get to see, like, one of the things I've seen in relation with my mom. She's 98. She's starting to, she's gone from a very independent, high quality of life. You know, three or four years ago, she would have still been walking in that march. You know, so now she's home, she's more frail, she's still lucid, but her body is starting to let go. And I had to see that she moves, when she's moving slowly, when she needs my help, there's a place in me, horrifying, but there's a place in me that wants revenge for how she treated me when I was a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't have time for me. She had three brothers coming one after the other, and I got left out. And I've done years of therapy, but it's still there. I feel abandoned and angry and vengeful.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like be impatient with her, just like she used to do with me. Mm-hmm. Come on, we have to hurry up. You're like, Mom, we have to go. And it's like, you know, she's putting on makeup and she's 98 years old and we're going to be late to meet people. I'm like, does it really matter if you put on makeup when you're 98 years old? I mean, I don't even put it on. I'm 67. But it's like, it's what she's done all her life. It's not just vanity. It's actually her respect for going out and being She's dressing to be with people. Mm-hmm. She's honoring her meeting with people. She's honoring herself and them. And at first, I couldn't feel that. I was so impatient. I was just like, I told you we had to leave. I have trouble with being on time, and I'm working so hard to get me on time. And then you know how to be on time. She doesn't have that same weakness mostly, but when I want to be someplace, she puts on makeup. I was like, this is so unfair. So I was just like, I was impatient. I was almost yanking at her like you yank at a little kid. And then I saw I was getting revenge. I was just, it just hurt so much. And it wasn't big. I didn't like slap her. She didn't slap me when I was a baby, and I didn't slap her, but I didn't have to. You know, Alice Miller, this writer who writes about how we wound our children and how we're wounded and how to heal, she says that false love, it's harder to heal from false love than it is to heal from outright abuse, because when you get hit, you know you're hit. But when you get false love, you think it's real. And she says the being will cling forever to that false love, and it can't turn around and see that that's a dead end, that someone's offering. That's why I stayed in the cult for 5 years, because I was desperate for the false love. I thought it was my life. And when I finally basically got kicked out of it, and it took me like to turn around and see there's a wide open door with real love, it took everything I had to walk through that door. I was still trying to go back. And that's, I think that's when I'm afraid of power tripping people, I'm not going to hit people, I'm not going to hammer on people, but I may give people false love, because that's what I come from. So the subtle ways that I wound my mother, that I get revenge on her, are much harder for her to push back than if I were cruel in an outward way. So that's what I think, looking at the mirror of the shadow. The shadow is exposed in this country. It's horrifying. But we all share in having something of the shadow in us. So it's not to say, do I do exactly the same thing as Trump? No, of course I don't. And to pretend that I did doesn't serve anybody. But to say, how do I have prejudice? How do I reject other people? How do I use alternative facts, quote unquote? No, how do I use falsehood and lies to defend my position? That I do. I lie to defend my position. It took huge work from my teacher to begin to expose that to me, because I was convinced that if there was one thing that I had going for me, it's that I was honest. I have other weaknesses. I'm late, I carry too much stuff around, I'm like, you know, I'm sloppy, but I am honest. And for my teacher to reveal to me that I lie to myself and other people, like I can say something to someone, something mean, and if you tell me 2 minutes later that I said that, I will say to you, I didn't say that. Now I will question myself, but even 10 years ago I would have just said, I didn't say that. Let me just finish this. So, because I couldn't admit that I had to get, it's a driving, to act out our wounds is a driving compulsion. So my compulsion to get revenge on my mother is a driving compulsion. My compulsion to take revenge on my son when he was a baby was a driving compulsion. I managed not to be physically abusive, but I had moments of rage that still hurt me. Even if they were silent, there was nobody with him. He was abandoned, even though I was 1 foot away. And it still hurts me. I can talk to him about it now. I can say, I hope you'll go to therapy, because someplace in you must have a wound.
I told my son, here's your therapy,
yeah,
girl.
Yeah, exactly. But they chose this life too, and they will heal. They will do, not that we heal everything, they will do their healing work. And this is a chance for us to see some of the healing work that we have to do.
So basically, use it as a mirror to remind ourselves that we also have a shadow. And
exactly.
How is that manifesting?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Thank
so,
you.
Just real quick.
Yeah.
I was going to ask if you would consider to share perhaps your birth date and a mailing address. I'll do my best to see if I can find a very styling, traveling hand cloth for you to wash and dry when you're out.
That's probably something I could use. That's practical help. Okay, so we have 5 minutes, Elise.
I just wanted to say, Rose, that your degree of self-honesty and self-reflection when you go to certain places, it cuts me to the quick. And so when I feel, when I let that in, and there's different levels going on here for, with this topic, but I so appreciate that, because that tender-heartedness is the place that I want to take action. I don't want to take action from desire to kill.
Yeah.
I want to take action from desire to help the situation, to better the situation.
To heal.
And so if I can touch that place in myself, then I can decide, am I the person that goes out and goes to port? Am I the person that sits in prayer in the cave? Am I the person that writes the newsletter and or creates an opportunity for people to gather? And that inner authority, for it to be authentic, I believe you have to ask these hard questions of yourself. If you don't, then that cycle repeats itself. The oppressed become the oppressors. It's historical. It's cyclical. And I don't want to be part of that.
Yeah, I think the Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche speaks about the tender heart of the warrior. And I think in another place he calls it the heart of sadness. And I think those are closely related, the willingness to be touched, really touched by the suffering of the world, brings us to a heart of sadness, but it's not a bad sadness. It's a tenderness. And if we can hold each other in that tenderness, then everything is possible. And everything is already here. I mean, it's paradoxical, because in the midst of everything that looks so broken, everything is here, and everything is part of one. So, it's a good place to stop. Thank you all. Thank you so much for being here.
Much on behalf of Ernie Rivers, I will point out two things. First, we have a donation bowl over there, and we encourage you to contribute to it to help us have further such talks, and also we split the donations with our speakers to further their work. Also, of course, we have copies of Rose's book over here, and other related books, and CDs, looks like a DVD.
Yeah. Can I say one thing, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, my teacher would always sell. I can't leave this room without the one moment. My teacher would have started with selling books and CDs and ended with books and CDs, and he would have been throwing books and CDs to anybody that would buy in the middle of a talk. So you missed that part. But there's great books put out by people from our community, including Lee Lazowick, but also students, and CDs from our bands, which I love. They are rock and roll. They are like the spiritual path through rock and roll and blues. And So, Words of Fire and Faith is by Lee. There's a Conscious Parenting book. There's Journey. There's a book on working with bullying, which Elise wrote, working with children. So, and any one of the CDs, you'll be happy if you take it home. So, take a look.
Absolutely. We just had a Taiyu workshop over the weekend, and in fact, we were reading from this book, and
which one's that?
That's the Self-Remembering the Path to Non-Judgmental Love, Practitioner's Manual. So some very good books here, so do check them out. And thank you all for coming tonight. I've enjoyed the event very much. Thank you, Rose, again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.